Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the SOMTV podcast. This is Jason Wise. On today's pod, we are getting closer and closer every day to the 10-year anniversary of the theatrical release of SOM, the first movie I ever directed and the reason we're all sitting here, I suppose. To celebrate that, I'm going to have Dustin Wilson, master sommelier and star of every one of those films and more on SOMTV, on the podcast today. We're going to talk about a lot of different things. Fatigue in the sommelier industry, what the wine business is like right now. We're going to talk over some bullshit as well. There's quite a bit of it in the wine business. And talk about how, when you work in an industry so long, how do you not get jaded? And if you do, how do you overcome it? Before that, I want to say we have some great stuff coming to SOMTV. We finally have our documentary about oysters, the entire process of what it's like to work on an oyster farm, what it's like to put them in restaurants, what they taste like, and what to drink with them, coming to SOMTV soon. We also have a huge documentary about Burgundy coming that I know all of you are going to love. We've been working on it for quite a while. So lots of great stuff coming to SOMTV. Go to SOMTV.com. You can find the best in food and wine content anywhere. Without further ado, my great friend, Dustin Wilson. Dusty, you are one of the great inspirations for me in wine and an inspiration for my next haircut, which I'm excited for. We're going to talk...
Very low maintenance.
We're going to talk a little bit about kind of the state of the sommelier profession from your standpoint and kind of just how you feel about, I guess, life at the moment. You know, let's talk about some bullshit in wine and the sommelier profession.
Let's do it.
Let me start this off with asking you, how are you doing? How's your...
I'm great.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm good. It's funny if you think back these last 10 years, how much stuff has changed since passing, since we made the movie. And, I'm great. Like, I'm a dad now, which I love. I have a couple of businesses that I'm involved in that I'm really excited about. And, I'm not as kind of deep into wine as I used to be. My world has changed quite a bit, for better or for worse.
Yeah.
Generally really happy and doing great.
Do you still love wine?
I still love wine.
Yeah.
I love to crack open a bottle, whether it's on like a random Tuesday night or ordering a bottle at a great restaurant and enjoying it. Now am I still, kind of geeking out the way that I used to back in the day? Definitely not.
Why not? I want to get into this because this business is I have seen it as both an outsider and an insider, is that it's relentless. You know, it is nonstop. There is no time off.
Yep.
There's no work-life balance that, I mean, I certainly don't have any. I would imagine you don't either.
Right.
What's happened to make you sort of say what you just said?
You know, it's interesting because I got the question all the time when I was taking the test of, you know, when you're that dedicated to it, when you're doing it all the time, you're reading about it, and you make it such a huge part of your life, do you start to lose the enjoyment of it? And back then I said no, and I was being dead honest. Like I really loved every aspect of it. I loved learning all the new things that I was learning all the time. But, you know, if I think about the way I wine in the context of my life now, it's just much different. I don't want to think about it all that much. I don't want to feel like I need to constantly stay up on absolutely everything all the time. There's certainly pressures to do that, but I've resorted back to simply enjoying it for enjoyment's sake. So I really still love wine. I like enjoying wine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't study wine or, follow all of the things that are happening in wine as much as I used to. Frankly, I just don't feel like I have to. And that's a younger person's game, I think.
And you're not that old. Come on. I mean,
I'm not young anymore.
You sound like my great uncle right now. It's good. Do you drink a lot more narrower things now?
Definitely drink a lot more narrow things. I've kind of, I've figured out what I like over the years and what I don't like.
It's all Camus. It's all Camus now.
I can get pitched on something new and can decide within 10 seconds if I think it's bullshit or not. And either perks my interest and I get really excited to try it, or I think it's just, this is obviously a sales pitch and I'm not interested in this type of thing, this category, mm-hmm. or this style of wine, whatever it is, and very quickly move on. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago, I would have been like, oh yeah, I want to try absolutely everything. I'm just not that anymore. But when I'm drinking wine at home, it's a pretty narrow band of, I know what I like. I like to stick with it.
What is that? What do you drink?
A lot of classic stuff. I mean, a lot of times you'll find me drinking either Chablis, Chenin Blanc,
Syrah,
Nebbiolo, Syrah, Pinot Noir, Sangiovese, and that's
pretty
and
wide.
Some Gamay, you know, and that's but that's kind of, you know, for the most part, that's it.
Yeah, I'm like nervous to ask you this question, but also want to ask it. I've been asked many times to ask people about the court and what happened with the court and all that stuff. And I don't know that we have to go through that whole story, but I think I want to ask you, what's the perception of the Court of Master Sommeliers, and has that changed for you and for the greater public? Does it still matter to be a Master Somm?
I think it definitely does. Absolutely. And I think, you know, since 2018, between the cheating scandal and then, you know, you kind of look at what happened over COVID, with their kind of response to Black Lives Matter, and then the scandal around, you know, inappropriate behavior. we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, something like that.
You know, they hit some rough spots for sure. And it went through a period where it was not only wasn't cool to be an MS, but you know, you're almost demonized to a certain extent if you were an MS, and some people left because of it. It went through kind of the reckoning I think they probably needed, to be honest. You know, the court has been around for a number of decades now, but you know, only honestly, you know, maybe thank yourself and the Somm films for bringing it more to prominence, but you know, it went from a smaller, for better or for worse. It went from a kind of a very niche, you know, very industry centric thing to a much broader attraction. And you know, I think that's a great thing overall. But it had to go through a little bit of a growth spurt in order to mature and get to a place that is, I think, where it's heading to now. And I think it had to deal with some of the legacy. Maybe problems or culture that existed within the organization that it needed to move on from. And you know, it took some getting beat up a little bit for it to be able to move past it. And I think it's doing that now. And I think, you know, as I think about where the industry is headed and the things that have happened since, you know, COVID, let's say, I think there's still a lot of, the court still is really important, I think. And I think we need a body and some sort of standard that needs to be set for, you know, whether it's knowledge or service or you know, hospitality surrounding wine in the industry. And there's still nothing better out there.
Yeah, but I think the big complaint with people going through the court is that, or the external complaint, is that people don't end up being sommeliers after they pass it. You know, it's like you train somebody for this ultimate greatness and they'll be the greatest server or greatest hospitality manager or greatest wine buyer or whatever else, but then they go on and they do something totally different, you know? And so, I don't know. I mean, it seems like that's the complaint, that you train a great quarterback and then they don't play on the field anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of that has really to do, I would attribute most of that just to the fact that, you know, restaurants don't have the ability to pay, you know, what an MS could potentially make doing something else. And, you know, if you think about where you are in your career, by the time you actually pass the MS, you've probably been in it for a while. You've been doing this for some time and you've dedicated a number of years to that exam. And by the time you actually get out and you've got one company that can offer you X, you know, or you can go work at a restaurant and kind of do the restaurant thing. And, most likely make significantly less. Yeah. You think about your long-term career path and what you want out of your life personally, whether it's a family or you want to be able to have a better means of living or whatever the case is, it's going to be really hard for people to decide to stay on the restaurant side. You know, if the quarterback was the least paid player on the team, nobody would want to be a quarterback, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, for better or for worse, that's just kind of part of it. I think there are some people that do stick around on the floor for some time after they pass, and that's great. But it's really hard to do that longer term when there's all these other options out there for people to go make a better living, you know, doing something else. So I don't blame them for that.
Yeah, no, understandable. Do restaurants need sommeliers still?
That's a really good question. I don't know.
Well, how can you not know? This is something you were at 11 Madison Park, you were at RN74, you were at that weird bar by the airport for a few years.
Yeah, listen, that was a fun bar. I was a sommelier for a long time. I have a lot of sommelier friends. I love sommeliers. I love the art of being a sommelier. I think I still have a great deal of respect for it as a profession. But I think where my mind goes with it is just, you know, what is wine in the context of restaurants as we move forward as a restaurant industry? And I think, you know, what I've been seeing that's slightly concerning is just that, wine is not quite as, significant to a restaurant's success as it was like kind of in my heyday, if you will. I think younger generation is drinking less. The types of wines that they're drinking are not the kind of really high-end classic types of things that, you know, we love to sell and that actually make sense for, you know, in order to justify having a sommelier, you need a big wine program, right?
Right.
Or you need at least a significant enough wine program to justify having a person that's dedicated to it in your restaurant that you're paying to deliver expertise and service of that wine. And if your restaurant, more and more restaurants these days are simply just not investing into the wine programs as much as they used to. So I think that's where I'm getting at with it is I just don't know if, I think until restaurants can be, or people want to go to restaurants more in the future to drink more wine and drink high-end wine and drink great wine, you know, the necessity for sommeliers is going to potentially dwindle. Now, you know, I can't see into the future. I don't know what that looks like. But for right now, it just feels like things are heading kind of in that direction where you see wine programs shrinking, restaurants getting a little tighter around their labor force and kind of the positions that they need in those four walls. So it's tricky. I don't know where it's going.
Is this an ongoing thing or is this because of just sort of the economy right now?
Yeah, it could be an economy thing. It could be a trend thing. It could be just, you know, like I said, younger people just not drinking as much as they, you know, we did when we were younger, mm-hmm. caring about wine as much as we did when we were younger. So we'll see. This is just a gut feeling that I have right now at this very moment, you know, whether this pans out in the way that I think it might. I don't know.
Would you say, I think you and I can both relate to the concept of kind of becoming jaded within an industry. I happen to have two of them that I'm jaded in right now, wine and film stuff. But, you know, at the same time, you keep doing it. And you're one of the most passionate people I've ever met, hands down, in any business, any field. And there must be something that still excites you. What's the last thing that happened where you're like, this is why I do this? This is the reason I do this job.
Honestly, the thing that I get the most excitement and joy out of these days is working with people who want to succeed in this world, in this industry, in the wine industry. You know, whether it's younger sommeliers or younger wine directors or people who are going through the quartermaster sommeliers or people who are just really passionate about wine and get really excited about it. I think it reminds me of me, you know, how I was when I was younger. And I love the fact that I get to be a person that they can come to as a resource or rely on, and I can mentor people. I really enjoy that. And not in the sense of, you know, I for better or for worse, I don't participate a lot in the court exams or classes or anything as much as I used to. I really enjoy it on more of a one-on-one kind of basis. And that to me is, you know, more than drinking wine, more than finding the new cool thing, more than the business, that's the kind of thing that gets me jazzed up the most at the moment.
Well, let's take this a little more positive here.
Sure.
What are you drinking that's exciting? Because you have a wine shop. I mean, you got all this stuff coming through all the time. But there's got to be something where you're like, I mean, there's got to be like a Tuesday at 10 a.m. where you're like, holy shit, I cannot believe that this just got put in front of me. Do you still have moments like that, or for the most
part?
Those
are very few and far between. It's few, yeah, it's very rare that these days that I see something new put in front of me that I get, really jazzed up about. It's hard.
Do you need a hug?
The thing that I still think I get the most jazzed about at the moment, and it's been this way for a bit, is Spanish wine. I think there's just a lot of really cool Spanish wine right now.
Like what? Ribera Sacra, Canary Island stuff?
Yeah, Ribera Sacra stuff is awesome. I like Canary Islands, but I'm not as much on that train. But I really love, I've been preaching this for a bit now, but Garnacha from like outside Madrid, Sierra de Gredos wine, particularly Grenache, is awesome. It's just like so, I love wines that can be really ethereal, really aromatic,
pretty affordable,
kind of exotic
too,
and spiced and just silky smooth on the palate, like, and very food friendly. That's kind of my vibe with generally with wine, and Spanish Grenache, as far as something new-ish, really hits all those points for me.
Yeah, it's actually affordable wine, which is the amazing thing.
Yeah, and that's the other thing too. I don't particularly enjoy spending an arm and a leg on a bottle. Like I like to find stuff personally in the kind of $30 to $50 range, which I know is not cheap, but it's not, you can spend a lot more.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on all the digitalization of wine? You know, all the apps. Not just all the apps, all the stuff. I mean, is it eroding the profession and eroding? Because I see it let me give you an analogy. Like streaming.
Like the Vivinos of the world.
For example. I guess. Yeah. I mean, if you look at streaming services and what they've done to actual film and cinema.
Yep.
Nobody makes an effort to go do anything, go out, go see a movie. It now is I'll wait for it to come to me. And if it doesn't, it's fault, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think wine is sort of following that kind of thing where it's becoming it's becoming democratized, but in that you sort of lose the exclusivity a little bit and it's not as exciting.
Yeah. I guess a couple of views on that. One, I think anything that's useful for the consumer to make wine more accessible to them and easier to understand and easier for them to get excited about, the more people you're going to end up getting into wine. And I think overall that's a really great thing. Yeah. And I also think technology to benefit a need in the consumer world is great. I also believe that change in any industry is inevitable, and you either roll with the punches and you change with it or you get left behind. So I don't blame technology or think where it's going is good or bad necessarily. It just is what it is. And I think we just have to understand where it's going and, where do we kind of fit into that in the grand scheme of things. I think if enough people start, the people that tend to use those are typically newer into wine or, early in their path, so to speak. And at a certain point in time, are going to want to speak to a professional that really knows what they're talking about and has a lot of credibility. So I think at a certain point, there's still a need for kind of what we do in that sense. But I think what I worry about is a similar kind of vein to critics to an extent. When a critic rates a wine, and has such influence, a whole mass of people will tend to follow whatever that one person is saying. And you're really just following one person's preference, Whereas some of these apps, I think, can do a similar thing. You tend to get scores or ratings applied to wines, and it loses some of the actual interesting, nuanced complexity that good wine can bring. And it boils it down to simply just a price and a score again. So I don't love that. But it is what it is. And we gotta deal with it. So we figure out how to work around it.
Well, when I met you, you were purely a sommelier on the floor. You were working at RN74 in San Francisco. And you were hustling harder than anybody. And then when Psalm 1 ended, you got a job out here in New York City. And you went across the coast, went to 11 Madison Park. And then you opened up Verve. We're sitting at Verve Wine where we filmed Psalm 3 at the same table. So that's been the course of 10 or so years.
Yep.
Now you are, as you described to me off mic prior, you spend your whole life looking at spreadsheets and balancing money. And it's not, you're no longer tactile the way you used to be.
Yeah.
But I, assume your feet don't hurt as much. Where do you see yourself in 10 years? Like, where are you going to, oh, what God. Do you want, what do you want to do in the next 10? Because you've had a pretty impressive rise in this field.
You know,
do you want to make wine? Do you want to get the
really
hell out of this business?
Question. No, definitely don't want to get out of the business. I love the business. I love the people. I still love the product. You know, and I think when you tend to be pretty good at one thing, to just kind of leave behind and jump into something else isn't necessarily in your best interest. But that's a really good question. I don't know. I don't know. I think it's funny because I was such a kind of a crazy animal, just chasing things down in the period that you and I met. I'm in a different place now. I think for me, it's the world I want to create for myself now is less about chasing achievement or huge growth or significance or building legacy or anything like that, which I cared a lot about before. Now it's more, you know, I've got a family and I've got a kid and another one about to come here very shortly that, you know, I care a lot about. And
it's the best.
It's about figuring out how to, you know, and a million people do this all the time, balance those two things, right? It's how do I create a world where I can still, the work that I do makes me happy and is something that I care a lot about. And I can also have enough time and have a lot of space in my world for my wife and kids and just doing the dad thing. Because to me, that's the joy that I see over the next, you know, couple decades is the memories that I get to create with that. So if I can go in that direction and have that be the thing for me, while also the career that I create for myself supports that, and that career is something that I get to be jazzed about on a regular basis, that to me is the goal. I don't know exactly what that looks like yet, but that's where I'm going.
Do you the last question, because I know you got to go and we got more filming to do, but do you remember the wine off the top of your head that was the one that said, all right, F this, I'm going to spend my life in this world? Do you have a wine that was like that? This was my like.
I have a wine that that changed the way I thought about wine.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say that it was the one that said, hey, I want to do this for a living, because I actually, when I first started getting into wine, I didn't know you could do this for a living. But it was a bottle of, I was working at a steakhouse. This was years ago. I was back in Baltimore working at Ruth's Chris. It was like when I first started getting into wine. I was reading Wine for Dummies, and that was my first wine book. And, you know, in my spare time, found myself going to wine stores and just perusing the shelves and, you know, zigzagging through aisles and things like that and just staring at stuff. And, you know, I don't think I ever really spent more than maybe 20, 25 bucks a bottle at the time. But the more I started getting into it, the more I got interested in trying, you know, more important things. And I happened to come across this, I can't remember what year this was, but it was a bottle of Les Forts de la Tour, which is the second wine of Chateau La Tour. The vintage was 2000. This had to have been in like 03 or 04, something
like that.
So it was
like a pretty young wine.
It was pretty young at the time, but you know, and 2000 was such a great vintage. Looking back, I should have bought it and just like stuck it somewhere and held on to it. But I bought it. I think I went home. It was like $75, which was way more than I'd ever spent on a bottle of wine at the time. And I went home and I think I drank it that night. And I remember popping open my wine book. I think by that point I had the Wine Atlas, the Hugh Johnson Jancis Robinson book, and got home. Popped that open, opened the bottle of wine, and just started reading about Bordeaux in more detail. And remember, my first smell and taste of that wine was like, whoa. Because it was just well beyond anything I'd ever really had before. And it was like, okay, this is what good wine tastes like. Holy shit. And it was like, okay, this is a different level. And it just opened up this whole Pandora's box of, well, what else is out there? I didn't realize wine could taste like this and smell like this. And I'm reading about it at the same time and understanding the significance of that winery and that place and all those things. And that's when it really started to take hold. So I attribute everything to that moment. Still not knowing that I could do this with my life. You know, it was just kind of a wow moment for wine.
Now imagine it for me getting to reap all the benefits, you know, because when you were in your most excited phase, I was getting to try all of the things you were excited about. And so this is all your fault, Dustin. I want to say thank you, dude. You are one of my, you know, one of my best friends in this world. And I deeply love you. Thanks for doing this.
It's been a wild ride. And, you know, it's funny to think about that moment that I had with that bottle and then kind of fast forward and the rabbit hole that it took me down and the fact that I got to get introduced to you and we made that funny movie years ago and here we still are. So yeah. It's been a wild ride for sure.
Yeah, well, it's
very
some
grateful
point,
for it. Yeah, very grateful.
I'm grateful to do it. You know, we'll do an animated one at some point. We'll do an adult film, which I'm looking forward to. That's Psalm 8. Is,
all right, I might stand on the sidelines for that one.
Going to be an adult film.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll be on the sidelines, but you'll absolutely be on camera. So it'll be good. All right, Dusty, we got work to do.
All right. Thank you so much.
We'll talk very soon.
Cheers.
I want to thank everybody for listening. It's always great to have the original cast of Psalm on the podcast. I want to tell all of you, go to psalmtv.com. Reminding you, we have lots and lots of great stuff coming from great wine regions in Europe and America, and our Oyster documentary, and much, much more. Plus, a lot of updates on our feature films like Cup of Salvation, Ghost of Spring Mountain, and our long, long in process Judgment of Paris series. All of that stuff is coming, and you can find info on psalmtv.com. I want to say thank you to our podcast producer, John Adams, who produced this episode. And if you are a Psalm TV subscriber, shortly you can watch this episode, and I advise you to. It's actually quite good, with quite a bit more to see than just to listen to on Psalm TV with Dustin and I. All right, everybody, be safe and drink something great.